Welcome to Diverse Voices Book Review. I'm Hopeton Hay. My guest is Charlize Lau. She is the author of Do I Dare Disturb the Universe? From the Projects to Prep School, it is a memoir. Charlize Lau was born in Cleveland in 1959 and is an alumna of Hawken Upper School, the A Better Chance program, and a 1981 graduate of Smith College. And Charlize, welcome to Diverse Voices Book Review.
Thank you. Thank you, Hopeton. Thank you for having me.
Well, Charlize, I have to say, when I heard about your memoir, when you spoke at the Austin African-American Book Festival, it really touched me personally because your experiences were so similar to my experiences growing up. And So why don't you first start us off by talking about what Do I Dare Disturb the Universe is all about?
Do I Dare Disturb the Universe is my not quite coming of age memoir, but it's the story of my seizing an educational opportunity that plucked me from a public housing project where I grew up in Cleveland, Ohio in the early 70s. My family of five, plus my mom six, was very, very poor. And this opportunity, the A Better Chance program, placed me in a private preparatory school about 25 miles outside of Cleveland. It's my story of navigating two worlds, the world of urban poverty and the world of extraordinary privilege and affluence that I encountered at the private school. And I emerge from this story or from this experience as a person who can sort of live in two worlds. And there are pluses and minuses to that. There's one world here and one world on the other side. And my life is this constant effort to merge those two worlds and sort of become a new being. And at the time, this was a new experience for African Americans. Today, it is not so new. Many, many, many youth have had these kinds of educational opportunities and learned to sort of navigate and negotiate these two worlds. And the fundamental lesson, lifelong lesson for me, is I've learned to become comfortable being uncomfortable.
One of the things I found just really unique about the narrative about your father not being with the family, your father struggling to find a job, was despite the fact that your parents weren't together, that he still gave you something, this love of learning that really sort of was kind of your North Star, seemed to me, reading your memoir, that despite the fact that he wasn't around, that time you did spend with him, his love of learning stuck with you.
Yeah, it's like an inheritance, a DNA that I got from my father. And we had very few encounters over the course of my growing up, maybe 10, maybe 15, but they were always, each encounter was pretty much centered on books. My father read voraciously for a man who was an alcoholic and had no job. He loved to read. He always had some new nugget of knowledge. And I came to admire that. And it came to be the connecting force between me and my father and a driver in my own life. If I could read, if I could learn something new, if I could bring it out and share it with him, pop it out. You know, this is what I learned. And this is, you know, we sort of, I wouldn't say we had a competition going on, but it sort of drove me. It was, as I said, the one connecting energy or force between us. And it has stayed with me throughout my life. I respect literature. I respect books. I respect intellect. And I respect my father. You know, you saw him on the street. He was, you know, toward the end of his life, he was homeless almost. You saw him on the street, you would have no idea of his intellectual capacity and his reading. And, you know, I think about his life and how, had he had more opportunity, he might have taught at a university or perhaps at an independent school, but he had a tremendous intellectual thirst.
And I think what's important for me is it sort of doesn't fit the stereotypical, the father left the home, doesn't support the family, that there is more nuance sometimes in a relationship between a father who's left the home with his children than is traditionally thought about. People don't necessarily think about it, even though he left the home, which, of course, you know, intimately, there was still something that a father can give his children.
Oh, absolutely. And I think in those times, you know, the 50s and 60s, there were little opportunities for a man like my father in a steel mill town like Cleveland. You know, the work was gritty. He wasn't an arrogant man, and he was willing to do any kind of work and did painting, you know, house painting. But, you know, for someone of his intellectual thirst, it was difficult to navigate that terrain. You know, you go to the bar, you know, I talk a lot about the Kinsman Bar and Grill, and it was full of blue collar workers, people who worked really hard for their living and hustled, you know, for their living. And my father did some hustling too, you know, a job here, a job there. But to talk the kind of talk he loved to talk about books, about World War II, you know, sometimes it was hard to find that conversation.
But you always were, in the memoir, you're so independent of your parents. So you love Black nationalism in the book, 1968 to 1977. We had the marches that would come across when you were, I believe, staying in the King Kennedy Estate, which was a brand new housing project that your mother moved you into. Mm-hmm. And I recall there's a point in the book where you're asking your father about certain types of books, and he doesn't seem to have that those types of books in his collection.
Hmm. Well, he was more centered on World War II and the history of the country. And I'm coming along with all my books written in the 70s. And he has no idea. But, you know, many of the books I read, Jubilee, the autobiography of Malcolm X, surprising to me. But he hadn't read those books.
So you start the book off with trying to find your father, successfully finding him, to let him know that you've got accepted into a Better Chance program to go to this elite private school, this day school, 25 miles from Cleveland. And you're also in this summer library contest to win tickets to see the great Al Green.
That's right.
You know. So here are the seven books: Rich Man, Poor Man, The mm-hmm. Learning Tree, Go Ask Alice, A Hero Ain't Nothing But a Sandwich, A Connecticut Yankee in King Arthur's Court, The Autobiography of Miss Jane Pittman, and One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest. And so this for me was so personal, because I'm reading your list and I'm saying, I read almost all the same books at some point in time too.
Yeah, those were the books that you read in the 1970s. That's what was in the library. And although my father hadn't read those books, I guess he saw in me his own love of learning. You know, it was just a mirror of his own love of learning. And he probably thought the books I was reading were pretty wacky, you know, because they weren't grounded, you know, in history as he knew them. You know, my mother, as poor as we were, you know, she bought us a set of encyclopedia and assigned each of us a letter to study. And that's how my father's approach in some ways to learning was. He had this desire to know the facts, you know, of World War II. I learned all about Hirohito and, you know, the Allies and the Axis, all of that. He was very grounded in that history. It meant something to him. An early understanding of Vietnam, those things meant something to him. And So the books I was reading, he probably thought this is light action. Let me show you back here in my room some real books. You know.
But I found the quote. So I found the quote from your memoir. You say, "There were no angry black books on my father's makeshift shelf, though racism had whipped hard at him. Maybe Charles Lyell saw life through a different lens, one that refused to focus on the white man as misery maker."
I think that is true. Although he suffered, you know, the blows of severe racism, he wasn't, as I understood him, he wasn't preoccupied with it. His quest or thirst for knowledge was, I won't say universal, but it sort of transcended racism. And I think it was just a whole body of literature that he didn't have access to. Maybe he didn't go to the library. I know he went to Goodwill's to get books and the Reader's Digest books. That was his library, the secondhand store. So it just really wasn't part of the intellect that I knew. I never heard that discussion from him. It's remarkable when you think about it, that he didn't seem particularly preoccupied with it. And perhaps that is because it had, you know, been accepted that this is the way the world was. Mm-hmm. I don't know, I can only guess. And I don't want to undermine my father's intellect. or maybe it was just something he never discussed with me. But he did not have those books. He didn't have any of those books. Many of those books were not written, frankly. You know.
Well, I think everyone isn't a revolutionary. I mean, you know, some people are, most people aren't. And so people just kind of sort of make their way the best as they can. But it's clear that him helping you to really appreciate thinking had such a positive role. And I guess as a parent, that just opened you up to so many other things, even the books, as you called them, of angry black men.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, when the Panthers marched through, when the Black Panthers or the Afro Sets, there were different names for these groups, marched through the housing project, they brought an incredibly positive, uplifting energy. Yes, there was anger in that energy, but the vision, you felt the vision as they came marching, you know, left, right, left, through the housing project and this amazing formation of unity. And then they stop, the cadence caller would stop the march and they would give their vow, Black Power. It was the first time I ever heard that. I don't know if my father ever heard that. You know, Black Power in the middle of the street. There was this proclamation, Black Power, red is your color, green is the ground you walk on, black is your skin. And there was no violence there, the way that the Panthers had been, you know, their image got marred and many of them went astray. But at that moment, to me, I say a 14-year-old girl growing up Afro and American, they were a source of inspiration and pride in Blackness, as poor as we were. And the work that they did in the housing project attested to their vision. They were masterful community organizers. They mastered the organization of breakfast, community breakfast for young people who, like myself, who didn't have much to eat in the morning. They organized, and this is really funny to me still, they organized trips to amusement parks.
You have a great story about that trip to the amusement park.
Yes, I forget the name, Chippewa Lake Park. We dressed in our black, you know, black Tams, black brogans.
Did you get the black brogans? Because I don't think you got them, right?
No, I didn't, but a lot of other people did. My mother wasn't really on board with that, but half the people came in with all this black. but we were just there to have fun. They were providing activities for us kids over the summer so we wouldn't get in trouble.
Wow.
And that was the work that they did. Some went astray, but that was the work that I knew the Panthers did and were capable of.
And this memoir really covers, there are a couple of themes for me that sort of resonated with me throughout. One was the urban riots of Cleveland, and you talk a lot about that and how that impacted your community. And specifically, you know, one of the interesting sidebars is how the ability to discuss that opened up women from the neighborhood you were living in before you moved to the King Kennedy Estates to talk to your mother, that your mother was, they didn't really talk to your mother, the fellow women in your neighborhood, the Steele Town neighborhood, didn't talk to your mother, but with the riots, all of a sudden, some of the wives actually would talk to her because of the riots.
Yeah, it was, you know, there's class division wherever you go. And there was class division on our old street on East 123rd because many of the fathers had jobs at the steel mill or the automotive plants in Cleveland at the time. And I didn't have a father. And when he showed up, he wasn't always in good shape, you know, and people saw that, you know, they saw that from their porches and their driveways, that we were a little different. We were bad off. You know, we didn't always have food. And they noticed that we got food at the beginning of the month because we got a little bit of assistance from the government. And so we were somewhat spurned. You know, we had friends who had jobs at the post office. We didn't have that. My mother cleaned people's houses. And so there was a little snobbery perhaps toward us. But when the riots happened, somehow this view that we were all in the same boat perhaps became clearer, and my mother became a little more accepted, you know, and our plight, I guess, was perhaps viewed a little more sympathetically when the riots happened.
The move to the King Kennedy Estates, a brand new housing project, your mother looked at as an incredible opportunity that then, as opposed to now, it was looked at as a great opportunity. Your mother saw it as an opportunity to be able to save money, to get ahead, to have more room for the kids in that particular, in the apartment that you had, as opposed to the house that you were living in it. But at the same time, you referred to the Cleveland Metropolitan Housing Authority as the CMHA ruled the projects like a king, the all-seeing CMHA. So I get the sense from your memoir that, number one, of course, no kid wants to leave their neighborhood. No kid wants to move from the neighborhood they're already comfortable with already. So saying you're going to leave that neighborhood to a new neighborhood is always a struggle. But two, I don't know whether you saw that at that point in time when you moved into the housing project, looking at CMHA, the Cleveland Metropolitan Housing Authority, that they ruled the projects like a king. Was that a conclusion you came to later? Or did you see that as a young woman? I believe, how old were you when you moved into the project? 13, 12?
I was about 12, more like 11. Yeah.
Okay. So did you see that when you moved there, or was that more in hindsight?
I think I saw it because I heard people say, you know, CMHA says we can't do this or we can't do that, or CMHA won't do this. They wouldn't clean up the incinerators. King Kennedy had these areas where you take your trash, open this sort of iron door, and you throw it into this giant, well, it was a brick closet of flames. It was an incinerator. And they were situated throughout the housing project in clusters of buildings. You'd have one incinerator. And when the heat was too hot, people would just leave their bag there and not throw it in. And some people just didn't want to open it up. And then there would be this sort of black ash that would sort of fall like snow over the area where the incinerators were. And that to me became the embodiment of CMHA's authority. Sometimes the incinerators would come on and the trash would burn. Other times the incinerators did not come on and the trash would pile up and the rats would feast. And so I think my sense of this housing authority ruling centered on that. And then conversation, you'd hear people say, well, we're under the control of CMHA. They own these buildings. They didn't really own them, you know, in the strictest sense of the word, but we were under their thumb, under their management. And sometimes that management was very poor. And King Kennedy, you know, I don't blame everything on CMHA. When you warehouse poor people who all have the same problems, you multiply their problems and you segregate them from the rest of society. It's a form of segregation, warehousing, poverty. And so poverty begets poverty. And so the housing project became just the opposite of what my mother had aspired to. It became a place where people stayed. They didn't go to the projects and get their footing and then move forward. They stayed because poverty, begets violence and all other kinds of social maladies. I don't put the projects down, but I do put down warehousing poverty and segregating it so no one can see us down here. Living in all this poverty. And so that was that's how I came to chase after rats.
you had a rat killing crew you describe in the memoir. But what's interesting is it became a news story, but then the media turned it on its head in terms of how they presented that story. And your mother was very upset about that story.
Yeah, we were bad kids instead of good kids trying to take control of our neighborhood, perhaps in the way that CMHA, the housing authority, should have been taking control. We took control, but we were misportrayed as those bad A kids from the housing project. And my mother was humiliated and embarrassed by our behavior, and that we were so bold as to go after rats. It wasn't exactly ladylike, you know.
So tell me about Dee Dee. You met her and you moved in November 1969. Mm-hmm. And you described her as a bully.
Yeah, I think as I said, in describing the housing project, poverty begets poverty. And there's this concentration of people who all have very intense problems. And it doesn't always bring out the best in people. And I think for many kids, we just got mean. And we saw so many things. We saw the robbery of the ice cream truck. The two men on that, the Isom brothers, shot almost right in front of our faces. We saw another car with a man murdered while we were playing kickball. You know, we saw the rats and how nobody cared, or the management didn't seem to care that they were proliferating and we were suffering. So you saw so much meanness, the meanness that poverty, concentrated poverty can bring. And that we sort of became mean. And Dee Dee was mean. She was just mean. And I picked up on some of that meanness too. My basic
I was about to get to your meanness.
my sassiness turned to meanness too.
To your teachers.
Yes, I wasn't always nice to my teachers, you know, even when they were trying to help me. You know, I wasn't always nice. I'm sorry now, but I hope I paid appropriate homage to them in the book.
Well, I tell you, you were brutally honest about yourself in this book. It was pretty clear that you were very open about some of the challenges that you faced personally, how you were always sarcastic and muttering under your breath to your teachers and junior high school. But there were some other challenges that you faced. You got kept back in third grade, yeah, and it sort of seemed to stigmatize you that you didn't feel that you were smart enough, mm-hmm, and you weren't really getting the support you needed outside of the couple of visits with your father to sort of overcome that stigma.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think I got held back because there was a lot of, you know, just a lot of chaos in my household at that time. And I was wildly distracted. And also think just personally, I'm a little neurodiverse. And in those times, if you were on a spectrum, none of that kind of support was around. You know, we now have that kind of support in our schools, individual education programs and so forth. But in those days, man, if you were a little off, you got put in a slow class. You know, you got put in a slow class or you got held back until they couldn't hold you back anymore. And they just let you go. So I think in some ways those kinds of issues were involved. And I had incredibly caring and deeply passionate teachers. Ms. Collins, I write about, she was just the liveliest, most vivacious, most creative teacher who kind of brought me out of myself and helped me to learn and helped me to love learning because she made it so much fun. It was so much fun. And, you know, I really, when Cleveland schools began to desegregate, a lot of those really terrific Black teachers were transported to the West Side, to white schools in the name of integration, not a bad thing, but we lost on the East Side a lot of terrific teachers who really cared about our futures and where we were going and could rescue kids like me who were a little off, a little off, a little slow. I could read like nobody's business, but I kept to myself. I was probably way too quiet, except for when I was getting smart with someone. And then there were times when I'd miss important things in the classroom. But had Miss Collins not been there, had Mrs. Moore, the teacher whom I lived with while I went to prep school, had those kinds of teachers and their passion and their caring for us as Black kids, had it not been there, I really don't know where I would be today. You know, I think my life trajectory would be quite different.
You talk about in the book a couple of writers you met. You met Maya Angelou. Mrs. Moore brought you to actually mm-hmm. meet her at a book signing. And you also saw Alex Haley speak mm-hmm. after he wrote Roots. Talk about the impact of seeing or hearing those monumental African-American authors.
Mm-hmm. Mrs. Moore was my biology teacher in ninth grade at Kennard Junior High School. And she offered, when I received the scholarship to go to prep school, we were going to turn down because we didn't have a car. Mrs. Moore offered to let me live with her and her husband. They lived closer to the school and she would drop me off at the bus stop every morning. And I think part of her personal mission was to sort of open the universe to me and show me the world. And part of that world was meeting Black authors. And I think she recognized I had a little bit of writing talent, even though I was a good biology student. And so she took me and another student downtown to the Higbee's department store when Maya Angelou's book was first published. And that left such a deep, deep impression on me to see this towering, gorgeous woman whose voice, I said, you know, when Maya Angelou spoke, you knew God was a woman. You know, that was the kind of vocalization that welled forth from her. And to see her, to touch her, and then to read her book so lyrical, it was a transformative experience for me. And then, you know, here we are in the 1970s and Roots comes on television. And Alex Haley comes, I think, to the University of Akron to speak on his book. And there he is live after I've watched this show that has given me a new sense of my identity as a African-American, as a Black person in America. Kuta Kente, Kizzy, this Chicken George, this incredible story. And then here are the people who put these words to page and gave them life, these stories. And so I pay homage and am deeply indebted to Mrs. Moore, another teacher who, you know, changed the trajectory, moved the trajectory forward with great velocity, you know. So, yeah.
So Mrs. Tears read your short story, did not necessarily believe you wrote it, but when she finally accepted that you actually wrote it, that was a game changer for you. That sort of put you on the path to ABC and the Hawkins School.
Yes, because again, I was in seventh grade. I think I got put in the slow class. And part of that was just attitude. You know, I just didn't do my work. You know, I would read on my own. I'd read books, but I didn't necessarily do my work. And I kind of had an attitude, as you can see from that portrait on the cover of the book. I had a little snark and sass going on, but I loved to write. I would write essays. I didn't realize they were essays at the time, and I would write stories. And so I wrote my story, and I guess it sounded pretty sophisticated to her. And she noted that maybe I shouldn't be in the slow class. And so I took some kind of, you know, dot test. You have to fill in the blank and stuff. I took some tests and I got moved up to, in those days, they had sections. Section one was the gifted and talented, the smartest kids, 2, 3, 4, and so on. And so I think I got moved up to section one or section two. And I loved the kids in my class. They did their work. So I started doing my work. You know, it shows you what association can accomplish. You know, they were doing their homework and I started doing my homework. And that led to more opportunities. But you know, just the teachers, the power of a teacher, the power of a caring teacher, you know, it's amazing.
So you decide that you want to go to a prep school. You were actually hoping to go to one of those schools where you would live on the East Coast in New England, on the East Coast, but you got into the day school and you wrote this about that transition, because transitioning from the housing projects to, as we talked about a little bit earlier in the interview, going to a school where most of the students come from privileged backgrounds. And you write, after 2 months of classes, 4 paper assignments, and 6 geometry exams, I felt woefully unprepared for the challenges of Hawkins School. All the glamour and glory of being a scholarship winner was gone. So you really, really figured out you weren't nowhere near as prepared as your fellow privileged students, but you had this strong desire and discipline and fortitude to really buckle down.
Yeah, I think this is such a pivotal moment. And I think many, many students encounter this, where they come to recognize that the education they have received at one point was not on a par with the education that their peers in a new educational setting have received. And it's a turning point moment. Either you go forward or you go backward. I accepted that, okay, the curriculum that I learned in my other school, I learned it fairly well, but it wasn't as challenging as the curriculum that these students had been exposed to. And the academic demands were not as great. You know, I wasn't given, you know, 25-page reading assignments, write 2 papers a week, you know, do, you know, 2 geometry exams a week. those kinds of demands were not placed on me. And the level of the curriculum exceeded, the intensity of the curriculum exceeded the curriculum that I had been exposed to in the public school. And so it was daunting, but the pressures, unspoken pressures often from my mother, and just from, you know, I'd gone this far. This is like an inner fortitude, really. It's like, I can't go back. I'm too much of a smart ass, you know, to go back.
But you kind of wanted to. You talk in a memoir that when you looked at Mrs. Moore, when you looked at your mother, when you thought about asking about stopping, that just looking at them and their and what they had invested in you making this transition led you to make the decision you're going to keep at it.
To keep on, to show up, to keep showing up and keep taking the C's. I was once an A student in the public school, but to keep on keeping on with the C's that I had received and fight through it. And I did. And it has given me resilience, a lifelong resilience to bounce back in the face of many, many challenges, personal, professional, and learning, lifelong learning, to hang in there. And I have this saying sometimes, don't insult your ancestors. And, you know, today I think all that my ancestors went through, and I have all of this, I had better not wimp out. You know, I just am not going to wimp out and whine about, you know, what I don't have or what somebody's done. It's up to me. It's really up to me. It's that inner fortitude, inner resilience that I learned that at Hawken. It really sort of shaped me in a very profound way, fair or unfair. Yes, the other students were entitled. There's no doubt. They had privileges, access that I did not have. But the resilience I gained there, I would not trade for anything.
Well, I want to close with this. You say, once again, referencing Hawken and Kennard Junior High, at the Hawken Upper School, students were prepared to lead. At Kennard Junior High School, where you went when you were living in the Kennedy Kane Estates, students were being prepared to follow. Mm-hmm. I think that is so profound.
Mm-hmm. That is the essence of our educational inequity in this country. Our curriculum in many public schools, much has changed, much has improved over the past 50 years, but there is an incredible unevenness that sustains inequity in this country, and that fuels injustice. And I truly believe the only way is to seize the upper hand with education. Now it's technical education. And I'm not totally convinced everybody needs to go to college nowadays. I think there are lots of other ways to learn, but you've got to learn. You've got to get an education so that you can lead and not follow. Because the way things have been traditionally set up is that there are two lines. One for those who will lead, who are privileged and entitled, and one line for those who must follow behind them. And I think we're in a game-changing era, though. People are seeing that there are ways to seize education, to seize opportunity, and not follow. And yeah, enough said.
Well, thank you very, very much for being a guest on Diverse Voices Book Review. Charlize Lowes, author of Do I Dare to Serve the Universe? From the Projects to Prep School. Thank you so much.
Thank you for the opportunity, Hopeton. Thank you so much.
Thank you for listening to Diverse Voices Book Review. I'm Hopeton Hay. host and producer. The theme music is provided by Wright Productions. You can follow the show on social media. Under Facebook and Instagram, it's Diverse Voices Book Review, or Twitter under @DiverseBooksHey.